And we're on air now.
Good evening, everybody. This is David Noble and Dalgetty Bay, and welcome to this evening's Radio Edu Talk. I'm delighted to have on the show, as always, John Johnson, who's over in Glasgow, and also history teacher Sean Huddleston. Sean, how are you this evening?
I'm grand. Yourself?
Yeah, not bad. Just hanging on, I think, to the Easter holidays. I don't know if John's as lucky as I am now that John's not my teacher anymore, but yeah, looking forward to it.
I think every teacher in Scotland will concur with those thoughts.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether everybody who listens to Edu Talk live or to the running is actually in the classroom or involved in maybe you know, social media as a teacher. But I must admit, things seem to have gone quite quiet recently. So I'm looking too much into that, but I find this a very, very quiet time of year. And I'm wondering whether, like many teachers, were obsessed with getting young people through their ASPs and NABs and such like. And
yeah, well, I remember when I started off as a probationer, my mentor, Dorothy Simpson in Shawlands Academy, said to me it was the long month of February. You had all the NABs and parents' nights and reports all squeezed into this very short month. And then March was just, like you say, the countdown to the Easter break, just getting everybody ready really for the big exams coming up, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, it's just been very curious. I'm somebody that uses Twitter quite a lot. There's just not, doesn't seem to be a lot happening, but I suppose everybody's got their own network and they'll be different. Kind of focus across different networks, but yeah, mm-hmm. It just seems like a strange time just now. So, Sean, I'm just wondering, we're going to talk all things history, and we might as well say from the start that neither John nor myself are historians in any way.
Right.
I suppose both obviously very interested in Scottish education and what's happening across each of the strands, or whatever you want to call it, of the new curriculum. So it'd be interesting to hear the kind of work that you're doing, you know, your current approaches to history education. And I think you're somebody who's maybe used different assessment techniques and maybe that's got a little bit of a history there and maybe mm-hmm. Assessment techniques in terms of the new curriculum. So, just be interesting, I suppose, if you could start off just by saying a bit about your career to date within education.
Okay. Right. Oh God, you're forced me to cast my mind back here, David, quite a bit now. I'm almost done my 10th year of teaching. Did teacher training in Jordan Hill 2002-2003. Did my probationary year 2003-2004 in Shawlands Academy, and I spent the next 4 to 5 months in several different schools, as is the way post-probationer, isn't it? And eventually I got into Paisley Grammar in January 2005. I was there until 2010 when I got made surplus.
And what does your kind of work consist of then? You know, within your present post, sounds as if you've got quite a range of responsibilities.
Yeah, well, it's a bit up in the air in the moment, David. Unfortunately, last May I got told I was surplus again, and because of that situation, my timetable was left reasonably sparse. In case I got drafted into another school quite quickly, you know, and it's been filled up steadily over the year because I also have a support for learning certificate, and I've been helping out in restorative practice room, for example, and the behaviour unit in Castlehead as well. But I've also got responsibility for a third year standard grade class, and I've got a higher history class as well.
Okay, and just before we kind of explore more about the you kind of work with history education, how you see it developing, and maybe kind of interesting ideas that you might want to share. But we're saying at this point, if anybody is listening to, for those of you who are listening to the live stream, that you can get in touch with the show with any comments or questions for Sean, or myself or John. The email address is edutalker. That's edutalkr. at hotmail.co.uk. And if you're on Twitter, if you just use the hashtag edutalk, then we'll be able to pick those up and put them to Sean or to John or myself. Sean, I'm just wondering if you want to say something about the work that you're doing just now. You know, I suppose in terms of the new curriculum, what's your kind of main area of focus? How are things going in terms of, you know, you're alluding to the fact that you're working with certificate groups. So I don't know if maybe what to start by just saying about where you feel things are at present for yourself and for historians and history teachers working within the Scottish system.
Okay, that's quite a big question, isn't it? David, with most subjects, there's quite a state of flux. Particularly with the new qualifications that are being brought in. The last 2 days, believe it or not, I've actually spent the vast majority of my time trying to get to grips with the new National 4s and National 5s, and also implementing curriculum for excellence level 4 experiences and outcomes with National 4. The National 4 course breakdown, if you want to call it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it, really. I'm losing track. Losing track of what I'm saying here.
I'm just interested. I'm somebody that tends to work with, you know, Access 3 courses and Intermediate 1 within my own context. And what's the? I've taken my eye off the ball slightly in the last couple of weeks. But
yeah,
you know, you're talking about, you know, kind of getting your head around National 4, National 5. Can you say a wee bit, maybe for listeners that aren't too familiar, you know, what we actually mean by that, and where we're at the moment in terms of publication of the, you know, are we still in the draft phase or have we finally? I mean, I was at a CFE event last night and still seemed to be some kind of uncertainty as to whether you know, we have the final published documents or whether they're about to be published.
Well, for the benefit of anybody listening who may not be familiar with everything we're discussing, we're obviously moving from standard grade qualifications to National 4s and National 5s. Now, standard grade history itself used to have three reasonably broad topics that you could select a variety of subtopics from. So, for example, you had international cooperation and conflict, and through that, most of the schools I've been in taught World War One. What we're now moving to is new qualifications, and they've got four units that now include a compulsory Scottish section, and it also has a compulsory project unit as well that didn't exist in standard grade before.
Okay, and this could, now, again, this is something I apologise if I'm getting this wrong, but you're saying about the compulsory project unit. Is that where we start to move into a kind of different regime of assessment? Is that where there's a kind of difference between how the project's assessed and how the other three units are?
Yeah, well, standard grade history used to be obviously externally assessed, and obviously the grade was given subsequently from that. Now, everything is going to be internally assessed, apart from National 5 and the project that you do now. The reasons for which I don't know. It's putting a big onus on teachers, whereas it used to be just getting the kids through the course. Now it's getting the kids through the course and also getting them, creating the assessments and then marking the assessments and then dishing out the grades.
So, and how have things changed for you then? I mean, obviously the new curriculum was meant to have been embedded, and we were to run with it last year. Now it seems that the kind of talk is about it being I don't know, it'd be different metaphors used now and different ways of kind of speaking of it in terms of, I suppose, lengthening out the time scale. So maybe say a bit about what kind of early work did you do once the, for example, the Green Folder came out with Experiences and Outcomes, and how is that kind of, how has your work kind of developed in terms of curricular design, and what's the kind of focus of your work, you know, maybe over the last few days? What have you been actually trying to tease out or establish? And I'm just trying to get a sense of how, you know, where you are at the moment and how things maybe are changing for you.
Again, everything's in a bit of state of flux at the minute, David, you know. Before, it used to be the curriculum, 5 to 14, it lent itself to just picking arbitrary topics and creating a course of study on that. You know, so, for example, the Vikings, the Egyptians, Nazis, slavery. Okay, you know, to select a few just off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a bigger focus on Scottish studies. And from what I can see, again, just over the last last 6 months or so of research I've been doing into it, there's a lot of focus on social and economic aspects of the past, which I feel, again, just narrows people's focus to quite modern history. It doesn't lend itself to the study of prehistory, for example, you know, the dinosaurs, cavemen, evolution, mm-hmm. and so on, which I think is possibly a bit too narrow a focus.
That's quite interesting. Sean, my background's primary, so I don't know an awful lot about the way secondary is. But my daughter's just finished university, but as part of that, she did a history degree, or half her degree was history. Mm-hmm. And as we sort of saw her go through, you know, the top end of primary, her standard grades, her hires, her sixth year, and then into university, she seemed to spend an awful lot of time on the rise of Nazi Germany. It did really seem like quite a narrow focus.
With the Nazis. Well, it's not just the Nazis, although there's still a lot of schools across, not just Scotland, but Britain, look at the Nazis. I feel that there's just too narrow focus on modern history, and particularly 20th century history. I'm not saying for one second, you know, it's not important to study the Nazis, you know, but for example, you know, I think things should have a more chronological feel to them. If you see where I'm coming from, you know,
there's
billions of years of history that we're missing out on, that there are now a lot of resources available to use, for example, films, the web, different kinds of technology available to you, that could make this a very interesting part of history to research and study. But yeah, you know, do we have to go back to the Nazis constantly?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Sean, but it sounds as if you're saying that far from liberating and giving greater autonomy to teachers or history teachers, that the new curriculum, the way you're reading off it, is that it's possibly actually constraining or limiting areas of history that you would like to teach. Is that the case, or are you able to circumvent the advice that's out there, or take the kind of nuances in some of the supposed woolly language of the Experiences and Outcomes and actually run with stuff that you know that young people are going to be interested in?
I take your point, David. I think it'd be fair to say that is my opinion, particularly as well when you consider we have to not possibly avoid but not replicate what the cluster primary schools are doing, for example, you know. There's no point doing the Victorians if they've done that in primary six, for example. I found a bit of difficulty in matching the experiences and outcomes with possible course changes I would like to implement. For example, I got access to different resources with regards to cavemen, inverted commas, you know, and the dinosaurs. But when I tried to put, you know, the relevant experience, you know, when I tried to find relevant experiences and outcomes that would allow me to do that officially, I suppose, I was struggling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting. I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here, but I know that that some people, and I would have to be honest that they're people who are very passionate about education that I'm thinking of, but who don't, you know, don't work with a curriculum or curriculum day out, would say that, I would claim I've said in the past, well, it's not about these grand topics anymore. It's about skills and capacities now. So,
yeah.
You know, you should be able to run with whatever topic or a range of topics, or you know, the kind of dreaded phrase for some teachers, and that make everything kind of interdisciplinary. Is the way that you would see history teachers working still very much about focusing on a particular topic in history or a particular phase in time or shared experience?
Regardless of what you pick, you're going to pick a topic, you know.
Yeah,
By its very definition, you're going to have to pick a topic. You'll have interdisciplinary studies, you know, that's fine, that's grand. But it comes back to, you've got experience in that, and you don't want to put the cart before the horse, you know. You can't study a different field of history, for example, for every single experience and outcome. You know, that's just impossible.
You want
pupils to get the most out of the expertise and knowledge that you have. You want a curriculum that isn't, you know, 10 miles wide but 1 inch deep. You want a bit of depth to something. You want to create greater understanding of that topic, and you want them to gain skills and various skills and abilities through that study.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you see where I'm going.
I think you said earlier on, Sean, that you're the sole historian in your staff. Have you a sense of what other history teachers across Scotland are saying, you know, either through associations, you know, face to face or whatever is being said on the web? You know, we've heard maybe from groups of science teachers and mathematicians and such like about their concerns, and I don't know whether they've been taken on board and whether resources and support's been made available. But you know, have you a sense of what the current general feeling is amongst history teachers, and what kind of response they've been getting, maybe from national agencies and government?
I can only speak anecdotally, but I think social subjects in general have been the Cinderella of the secondary school curriculum. In all the schools I was ever in, you could only ever pick one social subject going into standard grade, for example, or even higher for that matter. And there was always the fear that, while there wasn't so much fear of interdisciplinary work, there was a big fear of cross-curricular agendas being pushed, if you want to put it back like that. Not studying history per se, but having only vague aspects of history within some cross-curricular topic, if you want to put it like that. I know a few examples of schools choosing to study, for argument's sake, Scotland or, you know, human rights, but having different aspects and just, you know, barely touching the surface of history, you know,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is a particular fear of mine, and one I wouldn't be too happy about having to engage with.
So that seems to be the way that a lot of school, secondary schools that I've seen are approaching the curriculum for excellence at S1 and S2, mm-hmm. is to have a big, say, cross-curricular topic. So do you think that there's a danger of that being their only touch of history?
Yes, particularly with the new qualifications that are coming in, particularly if you're going to have to choose subjects at the end of S2 and S3, for example, you're not going to have an idea of what history is or modern studies is or geography is by studying a huge big topic that barely touches on either of those three individual subjects. And my fear is, once they get to a qualification, they don't really have a proper notion of what that subject is about.
This is something that I specialised in a kind of niche area of secondary education. It's kind of packaged with care and social work, and it's very different in many ways from, I suppose, what you might envisage as your typical secondary education. And it's only now that I'm starting to get up to speed, and I'm assuming there's a level of ignorance amongst listeners as well, but around the question of 2+2+2 and 3+3, and the broad, I know about the notion of CFE as a broad general education up until the end of S3, and then certification beyond that. You mentioned about, and this was something that I just became aware of yesterday, has been a massive issue for parents, or for those parents who are very involved in their children's education and the systems behind it, in terms of the choosing. I think parents I was hearing from last night were talking about their children choosing 8 subjects in second year and then just dropping 2 and going to 6 at the start of third year. So can you say a bit more about what all these things mean, and maybe not whether you want to refer in your own situation or your authority, but what kind of different ways are there out there that things are being done?
Short and sweet answer to that is I don't know. there's a lot of mixed messages out there. Nobody's entirely sure what is being implemented and what is not being implemented. And like you say, there's a great level of confusion as to how many subjects they pick at the end of second year. Will their choice be constrained? Will their choice be dictated to by finance and economics at the end of the day? Will it be constrained by staffing, for example? I really don't know what's happened. is the short answer to that. And I wish I could actually elaborate and clarify things, but I can't.
So maybe looking at the classes you're teaching in, so I would assume, Sean, you're still, I think you said earlier on, you're still teaching to standard grade, and that's very much remains relevant. Do you also teach, the likes of Intermediate 1?
No. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the short answer to that. I found the last couple of schools I've been in, because of staffing, they've simply removed intermediate. Mm-hmm. Because both schools, they had standard grade, and they used to have intermediate and history, or a higher history, beg your pardon. And because of staffing levels, falling rules, or whatever the case may be, they have removed intermediate altogether. Which it used a bit of a safety net, particularly for the higher kids, maybe found that the course a bit of a struggle, couldn't cope with it. You could say, right, drop down to intermediate, see how you go on with that, and then come back in a few months' time and see how you cope with higher again, That doesn't exist now. Although, again, I have been in schools where they didn't have standard grade and they taught intermediate. And then they made the big jump up to higher history, although there's an argument out there that says that intermediates prepare pupils probably a bit better for higher history than standard grade does.
Right. Uh-huh. Just going to say for those who are listening live, and I know John will back this up, there is, we are aware of a certain educator up in the very north of Scotland. I'll probably mention her name in a moment because I think she's asked a question for to put Sean in the spot. But just before I maybe ask Sean to say something about kind of assessment techniques and again who is thinking maybe changing with the new arrangements, the new curriculum. If you're listening live or even after the event, if you're listening to the archived audio, you can email Radio Edutalk at edutalker, that's edutalkr at hotmail.co.uk, and if you're on Twitter, please include the hashtag edutalk and we'll be able to pick up your questions or comments for Sean. Sean, you'd mentioned, you'd sent me some information a while back, just, you know, saying that you kind of, I think it was around assessments for learning and such like, it's something that you've had an interest in. So like to ask you about, you know, what kind of techniques have you used in the past that you found particularly effective, and even if you want to talk about the kind of, again, maybe returning to the first half of the show about maybe the kind of summative assessment, you know, what your kind of views of National 4s and 5s based on your reading of the documents that's out there just now. I suppose if you're somebody that's worked with an AIFL, then it'd probably be more interesting for listeners to hear about that kind of thing.
Okay. That is actually one pleasing aspect about the new qualifications. I think I'm actually well prepared for is that it's moving towards, I don't know what sort of terminology, continuous assessment and also some project based assessment. What I've actually been doing assessment wise, I'm pleased to say it's working extremely well, is first year and second year. What used to be the case was at the end of the unit, you do your end of unit test and you have loads of KU questions that would test the kids' general knowledge on that particular topic. You would have some inquiry skills questions that would present them with historical sources. They would have to judge them, analyze them, evaluate them, and so on. What we've started to move to now, in my own first year classes in particular, and second year classes, is more essay writing based assessment and the reduction of essay plans and logbooks that have shown the level of research that they've been engaged with. Instead of doing just one test with loads of rudimentary questions at the end, you allow them to choose one of the subtopics that they've been looking at, and they get to write an essay on it. What you're doing there is you're getting away from the notion that the test is trying to trick the children, stress the children out. What you're doing is, for all purposes, is you're raising their confidence. You're telling them, right, you picked the best thing you know lots about, and you're able to get marks through display of that knowledge. Is that making sense?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I find myself talking around in circles sometimes, sorry. I found that this is really helped kids' confidence get built up. It's moved away from a simple revision regurgitation type of assessment, and also where am I going with this? Oh god. You're getting the kids to show off their knowledge. You're getting the kids to show off what they've learned, as opposed to punishing them for what they haven't learned. Mm-hmm. You're also developing skills that are going to be used in other subjects and later on in other qualifications. For example, you know, essay structuring, essay writing, report writing, logbook creation, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Apologies for putting you in the spot here, Sean, but do you use technology at all for doing that, or is it it's all about the structured essay and the kind of feedback from yourself? Is it done in kind of traditional ways?
It's done in traditional ways, at the present moment, and mm-hmm. the reason for that is it's just access to technology. unfortunately, we just don't have the access that I've had in previous schools, mm-hmm. Where you might have had a full computer room readily available. We don't have that at the moment. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's detracted from it. In fact, in one way, it's enhanced that you're not relying on kids to go on the internet and find everything out themselves. Mm-hmm. They have to do our good old fashioned research through books and other controversial ways, you know.
just before I ask you mentioned a while back about your involvement in kind of cooperative learning techniques, but you've also, other than the kind of formative approaches that you've just outlined there, you've talked before about your involvement involving young people in peer and self-assessment and personal learning planning and kind of reflection on their own learning. So does that come into the essay writing, or is that something that is that these techniques that fit in elsewhere within your work with young people?
Again, it might have worked previously in other schools I was in, David. Again, just it's access to facilities and materials and what have you, you know. Just with the way things are at the minute, we just tend to keep things quite simple.
Mm-hmm. But can you talk about how you've kind of used these in the past though?
Well, previous school I was in, the second year course was quite rigorous, and it spun a range of individual, paired, and also group tasks. For example, individuals would go off and research famous individuals from history. There'd be a paired task to look at different aspects of Scottish history. And then, last but not least, you would have a group task that would involve looking at different aspects of European history and presenting their findings to the rest of the class as well.
And that, does that fit within cooperative learning? I've got to say, I haven't done the training in cooperative learning. I've not been to those workshops. I've not been in establishments where, you know, I've received training on that. It's something that I suppose, like other things, like learning rounds, where I've been very keen to be involved in, and eventually have, and you kind of see the light, and it's something that's really interesting. But first of all, I'm assuming that I've got that right, that you have been involved in using cooperative.
I've done a couple of
I suppose I'm saying, and how do you use it in the classroom?
It was just at the start of really implementing Curriculum for Excellence and AIFL. I wanted a completely different method to delivering history in the school I was in, and it also just happened that time that I'd had my first batch of cooperative teaching training, and I was able to apply a few different techniques and approaches I learned through that to also constructing new courses that I was implementing as well. And well, the proof of the pudding is always in the eating. We had the biggest intake in history for 4 years as a result of that new course coming in. The kids seemed to really enjoy it. It worked to their strengths, didn't highlight their weaknesses, you know, to a prohibitive level, if you see what I mean. It didn't put off, you know, the kids who may struggle with academically rigorous tasks. You know, they got stuck into proper research tasks, and particularly in the paired tasks, they're able to use a bit of peer mentoring to give them the confidence boost they needed at the right time as well.
So a visitor to your classroom at that time, you know, what would they see different from, you know, what they would class as a kind of a typical lesson or typical classroom environment? How is the support structured, or how does it happen? How do young people who lack confidence still manage to thrive in certain ways?
Well, I think the big difference was at that time, again, just through great access to a lot of superb facilities we had at that time. You wouldn't have found me in my own classroom. You would have found me in the library or one of the computer rooms, for example. You would have found some children working on computers. You would have found some children working at tables just doing research, the librarian being involved, different support staff being involved as well. Wouldn't it be much, to use that time old honored phrase, chalk and talk. It wouldn't have been teacher-led. It would have been a lot more teacher-facilitated.
So that sounds much more like a primary approach to maybe teaching history than what I remember from secondary. So the other thing I'm thinking, we kind of saw the more negative, restricting parts of the new curriculum. Do you think it's going to give you more opportunity to do this sort of type of learning, group work, using different methods of showing your knowledge?
I don't know about that. I think cooperative teaching techniques will help you do that. I don't know whether the curriculum's going to help me to do that.
You don't think Curriculum for Excellence stuff will free you up to allow you to use these rather than just chalk and talk and essay based work?
Not really, no.
No. Okay.
I think just the training I received and also the access to facilities I had, if I hadn't received either of those, I doubt I would have been able to implement a course such as that, you know?
Right.
For example, well, the present school I'm in doesn't have access to as much of those facilities as I had in previous schools, you know? And consequently, I can't facilitate that sort of course.
So it's resources rather than the curriculum that are controlling the way you teach?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Okay. This is probably changing the topic completely, but we've just had a tweet, well, probably a wee while ago actually, so sorry to Karen Braley, who asked the question. She said she was enjoying listening, and she was thinking about the project element, if that would be a pupil choice, if that was...
Everything I've looked at with regards to the course materials says it's a pupil choice. They'll choose from one of the different topics that they've been learning about, and from what I can see, they choose an essay question.
Folks, we seem to have just lost David and Sean. I'm just answering a Skype call. And
so there can be an oral presentation, there can be a PowerPoint, you can have a writing up extended response type presentation as well, which again brings me back to a previous point about maybe having the facilities to do some of these different things, you know. If you have access to great IT resources and facilities, then PowerPoints could be a way forward. If not, then you're going to have to revert to probably more, again, rudimentary and traditional types of presentation, i.e. writing up.
Yeah. So could you see maybe this project-based learning pulling in the group work as well, working together, or does it still have to be an individual project?
No, it has to be an individual project. It's all individual based. There's no group work.
Right. And how does that then, if all these pupils are choosing from a range of different projects, that'll then change the way you're working in class, because you can't teach class lessons, for instance, on a subject, maybe on a skill, but not a subject. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Well, what it'll probably involve is, again, I'm talking hypothetically, is going through each of the individual topics. You've got a Scottish topic to cover, a British topic to cover, and a European topic to cover. I don't think you'll be able to do the assignment / project unit until you cover all of them.
Right.
So I see it being, you know, the last few months of the academic year, really.
So we just maybe extend what they've already done?
Extend, expand, and just research it more and more thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Sean, I'm interested, I'm asking you this because you've clearly read up in the documents more recently and more thoroughly than I have, but we're saying it's possibly going to be towards the end of the course that young people would be working on their project, and are we looking at, you know, the elements of certain standard grades where you know, you have maybe an investigation or some kind of project where is it quite similar to that, and the difference being that it's packaged, or is it still done under exam conditions, but is it just the final version packaged and then sent away to be solely externally marked rather than internally at all?
Well, I find that the project and the new qualifications a lot more individual based research tasks. The investigation standard grade was really just extended inquiry skills where you look at historical sources and you evaluate them as part of the exam. You've got an 8-mark essay which you do a credit level, which probably displays your knowledge in a bit more, in a bit more expanded form, but nothing to the extent where you may be required to keep a logbook, for example, a bibliography of types, you know. There's nothing like that in standard grade. This is a very big ingredient of what makes these new qualifications stand out.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the logbook is going to be a kind of key part of the evidence then. But the young people will be able to work in their own time to produce whatever is then. Mm-hmm. Whatever sent off, or is it just the preparatory work that they can do in their own time? And does the final thing that is sent off have to be done under exam conditions? Again, from ignorance.
I just so happen to have in front of me, pupils should be given 40 hours for assignment, 8 hours for final preparation time and assessment. Mm-hmm. 40 hours, it's actually quite a long time, isn't it? And from what I can see, yes, you should send off logbooks, for example, along with the actual assignment / project. Uh-huh. Which again is a big big change from even intermediate history, where you didn't have an equivalent project based task like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of thinking aloud here, and it's but you seem to have, you know, where young people were working towards the final standard grade exam, there would be a strong emphasis on, you know, teaching and learning, I suppose, getting through the course and then exam techniques at the end, and that's easy to criticise that in terms of the risk of it being just about teaching to the test rather than good quality and teaching and learning through. But it sounds on the face of it, if you've got 3 units that are internally assessed and then 1 that's externally assessed, but surely is going to have to be monitored and maybe lots of these formative assessment techniques deployed, it's going to be an awful lot of work. And it seems to me as if it's going to be an awful lot of work and an awful lot of paperwork and summative internal assessments for teachers to administer.
It's going to be a lot of work. First of all, you've got to look at each historical topic and figure out, well, what the hell are you going to teach for a start? For example, you know, I've been looking at probable possible topics for studying. You then create the course materials. Like you're saying, you've got summative assessment that will have to be done internally. It'll obviously have to be marked internally as well, cross-marked as well. And then you come to the assignment, and you won't be able just obviously to throw that young person in and hope they produce a project. You're going to have to give them a lot of guidance, mm-hmm. possibly a bit of structure. I suspect, depending on the class you may have, you may even have to provide them with sampler questions, you know, to take and choose from. It is going to be a lot of work, David. On saying that, I've been looking at this over the last few days, and while there's certain aspects, i.e. workload, I'm very concerned about, I'm not so worried about something like the assignment or project unit, because I've managed to do that in the past and get through it, you know? But I can see colleagues of mine who maybe aren't familiar with that sort of approach being understandably worried.
We're just coming to the last couple of minutes of tonight's show, everyone. Again, if you want to email, it's edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, and if you're on Twitter, just use the hashtag edutalk. My final question, and maybe ask John to come in, is, Sean, it's just, you know, in terms of planning between now and the summer, and heaven forbid, even over the summer holidays, you know, what's the next stage for your own development in terms of the curriculum, and if you want to create a dichotomy, the assessment side of things, in terms of these new courses and the new arrangements?
Well, we're just deciding on the courses for a start, you know, and then making a start on creating course materials and whatnot. Coming back to an earlier point about the National Fours, National Fives, I get the feeling that possible course materials that will be centrally designed might take a while. I think there'll be anything up to 6 months coming out, and nature abhors a vacuum, so people are going to have to work around that. Now, what I'm looking at doing myself is using ebook technology to maybe create, you know, your own personal school textbook, as it were, and having it available for download. I'm also looking at the creation of revision apps as well, and again, just putting your own personal school stamp on that. The bottom line is something's better than nothing, and if the technology is available there. For instance, I was looking at the Apple ebook creator,
which iBooks
looks it's extremely user friendly, providing you're computer literate, of course. And having access to that could prove to be a very big advantage at a time when a lot of people may be floundering.
A couple of things, just one probably negative and one positive, or negative from your point of view. You were saying about cross-marking, and I suddenly realised you're the only historian in your school, and I always... I'm a primary teacher, but when we were doing 5 to 14 assessments, I always relied really heavily on my colleagues to give me a hand, to just look at things, and vice versa. You know, I'm a mark this right, or, you know, what? How do you manage that? Can you work with your social studies colleagues, or?
There's a couple of colleagues who are dual qualified, but they have been firmly established as RE teachers for the last few years, going on decades, actually. So they're having to become a bit more au fait with the history side of things a wee bit as of late. And that's where cross-marking, for example, higher history essays have managed to be accomplished through. Sometimes the faculty head will get involved as well and take a look at cross-marking the standard grade, for example, as well. So I'm not completely isolated by any matter means.
Not too alone.
And not too alone, but lonely enough.
I've had a brief look at iBooks author. I saw one that was produced by a chemistry teacher in the authority I work in, and a very quick time, and it was just very stunning, almost, that somebody could put something together like that from materials they already had so quickly. And I think that maybe is going to be a way forward if we have enough access to devices.
I don't know. I don't know a single teacher that doesn't have their own material bank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've all got lots of files on a laptop somewhere that you could easily bunch together, work around and actually create a proper textbook of sorts, you know? And like you're saying as well, it may even come to that in the absence of other materials being available, and other help being available. We shouldn't underestimate the movement of technology either. For instance, I saw a very staggering statistic, something like 80 to 90% of young people have access to either a tablet or app-based phone.
Yeah.
So why not use that technology to your advantage, you know?
Yeah, it just absolutely. Even if they can't use them in school, you can provide the files for them to download at home. And...
but yeah, it would be a change from the usual classroom approach to telling people to get those phones away and put them away, and actually tell them to get them out and get on with their homework, you know. So,
yeah.
It is going to require a mind shift in that sense. Yeah,
folks, I think we'll wrap up there. It's been there. Absolutely fascinating end to the discussion, looking at how technology can help with some of the constraints that we're working under. I'd really like to thank Sean for being an excellent guest tonight, and a very frank discussion about the new curriculum.
You're giving me a big head there, David. So you call me interesting.
Well, there's a lot more we could talk about. I'm fascinated about how the way you're working elsewhere on the web. It's fascinating. I'm sure we could talk all night, but I'd really like to thank you for being so frank and honest, as classroom teachers always are, when we're discussing with colleagues and others about the work that we do. I'm promising tonight I was not going to use the term curriculum for excellence. I think we've got to get beyond that phrase for a start. We'll call it the new all-encompassing curriculum, and I've certainly found it very helpful. There's been a lot I do appreciate there's a lot of information out on the web, you know, whether it's Education Scotland and SQA websites, and there's probably a few times during the discussion you could easily just say that, you know, David, just go and check the website, it's all there, but to actually hear somebody that's kind of wrestling with the documents and trying to...
You know yourself, David, I think we're only going to get through this with the help of each other now, aren't we? You know, your websites only go so far to help me to create stuff for all this, you know?
Yeah. So, thanks again, Sean. I really appreciate you taking the time out. I know it's very late on a I don't even know what day it is, a Wednesday night.
It's nearly always a Wednesday.
Still a bit to go to the holidays, so thank you very much again.
Not at all.
And just to remind listeners that next Wednesday night, that's fast forward, it'll be almost the end of term. That's Wednesday, the 28th of March, from 10 till 11 p.m. British Summer Time. We're going to be joined by Greg Whitby, who's the Executive Director of Schools. Here we go. See if I can get this right. In the Catholic Education Diocese of Parramatta in Australia, and Greg's going to be talking and taking questions live on the topic of learning in today's world. So I hope you can join us or listen into the archive of Greg's session next week. And indeed, Sean Hoddleston's discussion that we've been having with myself, David Noble, and John Johnson tonight will also be archived and available at edutalk.cc within the next few hours. So thanks to everyone again. Thanks for everyone who's been listening. And until next time, take care.
Good night.